Hello and welcome to Unleashed, the show that explores how to thrive as an independent professional. Unleashed is produced by Umbrex, which connects you with the world's top independent management consultants. I'm your host, Will Bachman, and I'm excited to be here today with Avi Punwasi, who is at Revenue Management Labs. Avi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, Avi, let's start at the top. So help teach me a bit about what is revenue management. I've heard this term specifically in kind of applied to airlines as they dynamically adjust their fees and manage both, you know, revenue and yield and hotels. But I know it's a broader topic. So help me understand how you think about the term revenue management.
Yeah, it's a question we get a lot. And the go-to answer that everyone clicks on is saying, okay, it just has to do with pricing. But it's wider than that. And usually where we like to start is, think about running a lemonade stand. And all the questions you need to answer if you're running a lemonade stand. So you'd start to think about what price should I sell my lemonade at? What kind of cup sizes should I offer? Should I have multiple flavors? What time of the day should I operate? Should I start to discount my inventory throughout the day? How should I plan? Now, as you're thinking about this simple lemonade stand that we're running, it gets pretty complicated really quickly. On all these questions, these finite questions that you're trying to answer that are discrete, but they're all related to one another. How we try to describe revenue management is looking at the answers to these questions. And when you look at the answer to these questions and you jigsaw them together, you might not be optimizing the answer to each of the questions, but when you put the questions together, you're optimizing the total result. So you're driving the most revenue and driving the most profit. And as you think about that, there's really four buckets that those questions are falling into. One, where your price is. And when you're thinking about your price, you're really thinking about what value am I delivering to my customers? And you're looking at that value versus the next best alternative. And that next best alternative could either be within your offering, or it could be the competitive market. That's kind of the first big bucket. The second bucket about is volume. And it's all about what are the ways that you're going to go about trying to generate volume? So you can do that with elements such as investing with different customers, and that investment you can think about it as marketing, you can think about it as price discounts, you can think about it as special pricing, you can think about it as customer programs. All those things we do, or the investments we make into the market to drive volume. The third pillar is around mix. And what mix, it's a complicated term, so I'm going to try to simplify this one. It's just looking at the different offers within your portfolio and how can we, and obviously you make different money on different offers, thinking about what you can do with presenting that offer portfolio so you can encourage customers to go to your higher margin items. And as you shift that demand, you're causing natural revenue growth and natural profit growth. And then the last element, which really gets to how you're executing those three elements, price, volume, and mix, is execution. So having the organization enabled that they can properly take that message to market. So if you're going out there and you're executing a price adjustment, you have great selling stories that the team can execute on. Or if you're working plans with customers, you're going through some joint business planning that you're helping them understand what you're doing and why it makes sense for them at the end of the day. So I apologize, Will. I know that's a really long-winded message, but it's not necessarily just plugging a bunch of data into a calculator like the airlines and the hotels are doing it and cranking out, hey, on this night, this is what we're going to charge for this room. It's really boiling back to through four big buckets. One, what you're going to do from your price. Two, what you're going to do from driving volume. Three, what you're going to do to drive mix of the purchases that are going on within your portfolio. And the last element is execution, how you bring all this to life and how you actually get that executed in your offers and executed to your customers in the market.
Fantastic. Could you walk me through an example, and as real as possible? You know, maybe it's a real client example that you can sanitize of the client name. But walk me through an example. I'd love to hear sort of end to end on a project, how you would, you know, what phase one looks like, you know, collecting information, understanding the objectives, and then how do you go through this? There's so many different variables and dimensions. I'm quite curious to hear how you think about doing it in a practical way, right? Because there's, you know, probably some infinite number of possible moves. So how do you model it? Do you use Excel? So just walk us through a project, what we would see, you know, if we were, you know, working in your team room and watching what was going on.
Yeah, sure. No problem. So I can give you an example. I'll pick a recent example. So this was an aftermarket automotive parts manufacturer. And basically how their pricing was driven was they would look what's happening with their commodity costs, or they'd look what's happening with tariffs. And based on those moves, it would drive their pricing strategy. And also, if they were procuring those parts, not necessarily manufacturing them from third parties, they would look at what's happening for their from supplier costs as they're coming in, and they'd adjust their pricing. So it's basically the traditional cost-based pricing. They would look at all their costs. They were incredibly good at looking at their costs. They would bank on a standard margin, and they'd arrive at their price. What they were finding was that they were losing a significant amount of volume. And they were finding that customers were walking away from them in some instances and delisting their products.
Delisting, wow. And this was an example of they're not making something that's so unique. It sounds like they were making something that there were some other similar companies making this aftermarket product.
Exactly. And their competition was coming from two areas. One, they were selling through Amazon and whatnot, but they were selling through retail channels, and they were also selling through distributors. And what they were coping with was there was a lot of imports that were coming from overseas that were extremely cheap. But retailers, just kind of in the past 5 to 10 years, they were starting to introduce their own private label products. Mm-hmm. And they were competing. So they were holding their branded products kind of up here high, and then they were introducing these private label offerings, and they were aggressively pushing their private label offerings. And it was starting to cannibalize sales, but some of these private label offerings were becoming so dominant that the retailer themselves was saying, you know what, I don't even need to carry your brand anymore, or you're no longer relevant to me in certain areas of your portfolio. So as they were looking at what they were running into, the issue was, is, hey, we can just go ahead and cut the standard margin, but we're not really sure how far or what we should do or where we really need to be positioned. And that's where they came to us. And the first step that we took was to start to understand, one, what is our position within the market? So it's nice having dealing with vehicles because there's a lot of data available. And there's solves if you don't have this great visibility on data. But with vehicle data that's out there, we know how many vehicles are running around in the market. We know how often those vehicles are getting repaired for certain types of repairs. And we know how many parts per job are being used. So by doing the math, you can understand what's the total market size out there. And we were also able to understand, we knew how much they were selling. So very quickly, we could look at the portfolio and we could take a look at, well, here are some areas that were really under indexed and here are some areas that were incredibly strong. The next thing that we did was, as you can imagine, auto parts, sometimes you're dealing with a portfolio with hundreds of thousands of parts. It's huge. So cost plus makes a lot of sense to price in that manner because it's simple. You just have a cost, you do a calculation on it, and you're done. Your price is done, and you're not having to go through product by product. The problem is, and this spreads for whether it's a product or it's a service, some of the products that you make are commodities. So you're right. I wouldn't be able to tell the difference if it's a private label product, if it's a branded product. There's really no differentiation. And in those cases, it's just a market-based pricing. You might be able to command a couple of points for value differential because I can get you the part there quicker than everyone else, or I'm stocking it at a certain level. And then some parts are incredibly differentiated. We're later on in the product life cycle. I'm the only one who's stocking it. I have special technical competency within this part. It has a high failure rate on this part, or it's an incredibly difficult repair. I'm not going to mess around with a private label part because if I go and use that private label part and it takes me 8 hours of labor and I have to replace it again, it's just not worth it. It doesn't make sense to me. But critical on that is there's all these different value differentiating attributes around these parts. So what we did was we spent some time segmenting.
Yeah, and just a question here. And are we mainly talking about parts that a mechanic would buy, so a shop would buy, or are we talking about things that a individual consumer would be purchasing from like a AutoZone or something?
Both. So, it differed. So some of it was the repair shop buying, and some of it would be the do-it-yourself, or walking into an AutoZone, I'm going to go and pick up this filter and go and put that onto my car. So again, that was an additional wrinkle on it. So based on that, hey, if we're selling the same amount to the repair shops versus a do-it-yourself customer, it's going to necessitate a different price, a different pricing strategy than if it's all going through the repair shop. Hmm. Now, what's kind of critical to that is, as we're talking about all these different behavioral attributes, so I have these items that are really old, fit really old vehicles, or these items that really do-it-yourselfers are using, or these items that are more commodities. We're just talking about segmentation, really. How do we look at like items and bucket them together? So the next piece that we did was we took the entire portfolio and we started to create these buckets of parts. And the buckets of parts sat together because they exhibited likewise behavioral elements. So we see it's primarily do-it-yourself. We see that there it's for older vehicles. We see that we have this competition. We see that we have these price elasticity on these parts. Now, with developing these buckets, we're going from 300,000 parts. Now we've got kind of 20 buckets. What we can do is by each of these buckets, we looked at each of those buckets and we said, okay, well, how are we standing from a market share perspective? How are we, what's our price gap versus the competition? What's our price elasticity on this part grouping? And we could start to do some modeling and understand if we were to increase the price, how much incremental volume could we expect? And with that incremental volume, does it make sense from a profitability standpoint?
Do mechanics?
And by going through each of these 20 buckets, we were able to develop 20 unique price strategies.
Do mechanics care about the price? Like, at least my mechanic, I think, probably just sort of just marks it up to me. Maybe I could imagine something, odd where they might actually prefer higher priced parts because, well, if they just have a standard policy of marking it up 100% to the customer, the more they pay, the more profit they make.
That is a great point. And you know what? Definitely in certain product groups, that's exactly it. You know what? I can see that our product is 80% above the private label competition or any branded competition. I have 95% of the market share, and it's exactly that. You know what? I'm the brand. It's a highly critical repair, and a mechanic is going to make more money actually installing my part. Where the issue was starting to come at was the mechanic was buying through a distributor, and the additional wrinkle comes into the system in that the distributor, sometimes the dollars that are making off of a private label part versus selling a branded part from a supplier, it's a different, they could be making more off that private label. So they're pushing the private label very hard and incenting mechanics in some instances to go ahead and buy the private label over and above the branded. So it's starting to understand how to think about those different channel dynamics. How do we structure our price so when it's presented to the mechanic and so a mechanic signs on to, you know, a NAPA website and they see, here's where I can buy the NAPA kind of blue box product for, or here's where I can go ahead and buy the branded product for, and understanding really where's that differential where the mechanic will go, yep, I'm going to go with that branded product, or you know what, the difference is too substantial, I'm going to go with that private label product that's being pushed at me.
I'm sorry, I don't want to get us off track too much here, but where do mechanics typically buy the parts? Like, do they buy them from the same kind of retailers that you and I would buy them for our own car? Or is there like a whole hidden separate world of distributors that sell just to mechanics that we don't even like know about, that are not really like name brands that I would even know exist?
Yeah, so there's kind of two tiers. There is exactly that whole separate world who there's a lot of purely automotive distributors out there that are selling to these repair shops. And then you'd see the names you would recognize, the retail names like the NAPAs, the AutoZones of the world, the O'Reillys, who not only sell to the do-it-yourself customers, but they're going out there and they're going to conquest those repair shop customers as well. And it's a battle between the traditional distributors and the retail, those new kind of retailers that are out there that are encroaching on that are fighting for that business. And of course, as you can imagine, price has a lot to do with that battle right now.
Okay, great. So that helps orient me a little bit in terms of the market we're talking about. So these are aftermarket parts for auto, and my guess would be that like most of the dollars are probably selling it to the shops, I would think. Is that right? Like,
it's probably 80-20.
Yeah.
You're with the split. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't go out and buy like brake pads or a new catalytic converter myself and install it. So I'll be lucky to change the wipers on my car myself.
Here, I'm in the same boat, same boat as you.
I'll admit. Okay, so you're doing this this look, and I love this interesting idea of how you put together like 20 different categories based on the kind of buying behavior of it. Is this mostly consumer purchased or purchased at a shop, and you know, how sensitive is the how price sensitive it is, it so, and like what's our cost? So you've come up with all these categories. Okay, keep going, keep walking through. I got you off track.
Also, the one element that the organization wasn't looking at very closely at all was looking at where competition was, and there were certain products that we were looking at that we looked at where the competitive market was positioned, and we looked at what we were buying that product for. So we might have been buying that product from a third party, and we're actually buying it from the third party higher than what competition was selling at. So there were certain products that were like, this is a whole different problem than pricing. It's more of a supplier procurement problem that we need to figure out. But looking at coming up with those 20 pricing with each of those groupings, we came up with unique pricing strategies for each. And we modeled that all out using the elasticity. We modeled that out from two perspectives. Not only did we model it out from an internal perspective, which is important, but exactly where you've been going already. In order to get the price that we charge to the customer is one thing, but where the rubber hits the road or where the pull actually happens is when their end customer looks at that, when the repair shop looks at the making order and choosing what product they're going to get, it's that price that the retailer or the distributor actually needs to affect. And what was happening over time is, in the past, since this manufacturer had really just been pricing based on cost, well, their customers had gotten smarter. So they were going ahead and they would go and say, you know what, copper and corrugated is up by 2%. We're taking a 2% price increase right across. Well, when they go and they change their price into their customers, they're going, well, on part group A, they took 2%, I'm going to take 6%. So over time, the channel that they had been selling into had margined up significantly. So the next challenge is we knew where we wanted our pricing to be positioned.
Can you explain that term margined up? So you're saying their competitors' prices had gone up more than theirs? I don't understand the margined up piece.
Oh, no problem. So I apologize. So basically, if I was, they were selling it into product into a store at $2. The store goes ahead and takes a margin on it of $2, and then the store sells it to $4 to end customer. What had happened was, let's say I take my price from $2 to $2.10. So I took a 5% price increase. What we would expect is, you know what? If they want to maintain their same margin, they would go ahead and say, okay, I was selling it for $4. I'm going to go ahead and increase, take a 5% price increase as well. And my $4 will go to $4.20. So, you know, I'm making a little bit more money because it's a higher out of pocket. But what was happening, instead of going to $4.20, they were going to $4.50. So, they were making much more they were passing much more price to the market. And this had been contributing to a little bit of where the pricing versus competition had gotten out of sync as well. So now we had these new price targets that we wanted to do on these 20 categories. What we really transitioned into was going customer by customer, item by item, looking at where that customer had that product priced, where we wanted that product to be priced, looking at if that customer brought their price down to that level, how much volume they could expect to pick up, and showing, building sales stories, basically, that we could go into a customer and say, hey, in the past, we were pricing based on cost. It didn't really make sense for... We weren't really looking at our competition. We weren't really looking at the value we were delivering to the market, and we weren't driving the maximum category value that we could to you. Now, here's our new insights around how we're looking at our parts, and we want to make sure as a category partner we can drive value for you. And what we did was basically big account by big account was really going through and building sell stories to show them, here's what where your pricing is right now. Here's where we recommend your pricing going to. If you do this, here's what your financials should transition to. And net-net, if you go ahead and take this, take these price adjustments, up, both up and up where you have leverage, down where we see that there's incremental volume opportunity, you're going to be net-net make more money. And at the same time, here's the mechanism that we'll use to track it with you on an ongoing basis. So what was great about that was it's not only making it very concrete and helping them understand what you're doing, but it was really starting to tie this supplier into the customer by helping them proactively manage the customer on a quarterly basis and make it much more of a partnership versus, hey, core gets gone up by 2%, your price is going up by 2%. It's much more so, how do we drive value for both of ourselves in partnership and help continue to drive category value? It changed the whole nature of the discussion, even though we were looking internally and how we could drive the maximum revenue, maximum profit internally. It's also linked to our customers driving the maximum revenue and maximum profit, and how do we start to work in partnership.
So they were working with the retailer to, you know, kind of say, you know, to suggest the actual retail price and that they were charging the end customer as well, and helping the retailer figure out there were some places where they should raise their prices and they can get more margin, but some places where they should really lower their prices so this product would be more competitive.
Exactly. And thing about that is a lot of, especially B2Bs, they consider their immediate customer and they're very close in managing their price, but they're not necessarily looking at the other steps in the value chain and thinking about where, what value is being created and where you need to be positioned. But it's important. So you can understand if you can understand the entire value chain, you can understand if it makes sense to the end customer or not. And then based on that, how do you need to change your price, or do you have leverage, or do you need to adjust?
How did the retailers respond to that? Because I could imagine I could imagine two reactions. Some might say, oh, wow, this is genius analysis. Thank you so much. We'll do exactly what you say, and we'll make more money. And some might just say, hey, we'll manage our business. You manage yours. We'll decide what price to charge. Right? What kind of reaction did they get?
You know what? It's funny. It's very close to that dichotomy that you're outlining. Some were said right away, I understand. You know, we see this in a lot of other industries, or I see this in a lot of other places, and it's refreshing that you're bringing this to your portfolio and bringing this management to the category. Yep, the strategy makes sense. Let's continue to move it. Others took the opinion. Some didn't understand. Like, it was literally, and it's going to take time to help educate them on, let me help you understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, and why this makes sense for your financials. So it's honestly helping them understand their financial statements and how they're creating leverage with pricing through their financial statements. Others took the exact approach that you came at with, you know what, our price is our business, you guys manage your price. But at the same time, working through that discussion, because helping them understand, here's what we're doing with our price and why we think it makes sense, you still naturally go back to, we were able to transition those discussions back to their price naturally, because they would say, well, we're not going to accept that price increase or whatnot. And we'd come back to, well, here's where the market opportunity is. And they would be forced back into the discussion of, well, we don't necessarily think there's a market opportunity there, and here's why. And it opened up that discussion, the back and forth on, well, here's why we think there is that market opportunity, and to start exploring options like, okay, let's test on this sample, or let's have it run within this region for this time period and go and vet that out. So you will have customers that push back and say, you know, that's our business, but it's a process. And just starting that discussion, showing them that you have a good understanding of the market, you have a good understanding of the customer, and it's very powerful. If you've done the math and you can show them the math with their numbers, It's hard to debate. Here's what your numbers are showing us, and here's where the data is leading us. It makes the discussion much more concrete and objective than usually what's happening is more of an emotional discussion without that level of granularity or data behind it.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you actually do this calculation? Let's assume that, I mean, I don't know what category specifically your client was, but let's pick something like replacement headlamp. I don't know, right?
Sure.
And so let's say, okay, so for a certain class of car, there's probably a certain class of, you know, serial number of headlamp, and there might be some various private label and different manufacturers make it, and you can get it at different stores. So let's say that you've collected all that information. You have a sense of, all right, there's so many Toyota Siennas on the road. Every so often you have to replace the headlamp every, I don't know, 4 years or something, 10 years, I don't know. And so therefore, so many people should be buying them. And you know what the prices are, you know your market share, but then how do you actually go about, like, what assumptions are you making? How do you do the calculation to say, okay, well, if we adjust our price from, you know, $15 to $16, and the final price to the consumer goes from X to Y, how do you assume and, you know, determine what the volume change would be based on those changes? Because, yeah, maybe it goes up at AutoZone, but, you know, does that really increase sales? Like, if I walk into AutoZone, I'm not going to say, oh, the price went up $2. I'm going to go over across this, you know, like, I'm going to drive somewhere else a mile away and buy it there. Like, price is what it is. So how do you model that volume change?
Yeah. And there's a couple ways to model that volume change. It really depends on what information is available to you. So in certain instances, when information is not available to you, and this is by no, it's usually not the case, but you're forced to go out there and you're forced to actually do some research, and you go ahead and you present different offers to customers. So for example, in this case, let's say I had absolutely no data available to myself. You go and put it in front of customers that you're nowhere in the category, and you'd show them a shelf, see what they purchase. Then you show them another shelf, move prices around, and you see if it adjusts what they actually are purchasing. Now, usually where we're calculating the elasticity or that volume reaction is using either customer transactional data that's available to us or internal transaction data. In this case, because a lot of industries just don't have customer data. For example, like retailers supplying back data to them or distributors supplying back data, they usually only have their internal shipment data. So what we do in that instance is we take a look at, and ideally you have somewhere around 3 years of data. If you have more, it's great. You're looking at, and this is at an invoice level, here is the part level, here is the price that I sold that part at, here's the volumes that I'm selling against that product. And what you're trying to do with this data is, first off, you're trying to normalize it. And when I say normalize that data, there's certain things that are happening in the data that are causing the volume to go up and down. So you'll have things like seasonality happening. You'll have things like picking up new customers or losing customers. You'll have in the item of parts that we're talking about, there's a natural product life cycle. So, you know, if I'm putting in parts on a 2002 Camry, that as I move a year ahead, well, there's just less 2002 Camrys that are running around out there. So my volume is, I might be performing at the exact same level, but there's just less cars out there. So I'm going to see a natural volume drop off. So we normalize all of that out of the data, and we look at what prices have actually happened in the past and what volume has moved. And we're looking at this on a total level. We're looking at this at a category level. We're looking at this at a customer level. And going through that analysis, we're able to drive out what elasticities are occurring by part, by SKU, and by segment. And that really provides the basis to help us understand these groups of parts. If I go ahead and move price on those, we've seen some pretty significant volume shifts. If I move these parts, I don't see that the volume hardly shifts. So they're pretty inelastic. We should be looking at taking some price adjustment, slow and steady price increases on these, because it's pretty substantial improvement for profitability.
That makes a ton of sense. So then tell me a little bit about the last step you mentioned when we started out, step four, execution. Talk to me a little bit about that with this client example.
Yeah. As I said, in the past, the team was very used to even having a note from their suppliers saying, hey, we're taking a 2% price increase on you because these core metals have gone up. And then they would walk into the retailers or walk into the distributors, show them a copy of that note, and then say, hey, because they're taking their price up on it, that's why we're taking our price up. Well, this process that I just walked you through at a very high level, it's a whole new way of thinking. It's thinking about what value you're driving to the customer versus the competition, what kind of price gap you need versus the competition, where you're going to maximize your volume. So what we had to focus on was, how do we educate the sales team to deliver that message? So we helped put together a sales story, educate them on how to think about delivering that and role play through delivering that, what kind of objections they're going to get and how to handle those objections. As they're going through that sales process, as they're getting customer pushbacks, how to, where we'll negotiate and what we'll negotiate on, and doing deep dives off of that. And also from that execution piece is monitoring that, hey, that price actually got changed in the system. We said we were going to take it to $5. The price got changed to $5. The sales rep didn't put in any incremental customer funding on that. And here's how the volume's coming out. So you're going through that closed loop process of monitoring and making sure that that oversight's in there, that there's nothing that happens on the back end. A lot of times what we see is that companies think they're out there, they're going and they're getting price increases, but by the time they look at their financials and they see what they actually achieved on the bottom line, it's evaporated. And why it's evaporated is, in a lot of instances, either the price adjustment wasn't taken, or additional investments were made in that customer in other areas, special incentives or programs or terms given that basically spent back that entire price adjustment. So that execution piece is just as important as having the insights and being able to come to good concrete insights, because if you can't execute it, you can't actually make sure that the action was taken at the customer and that the dollars are rolling through on the bottom line.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your firm, Revenue Management Labs. So could you just tell us a little bit of the story of it and the size you are today? You currently have a number of both full-time folks, and I think, I'm not sure if you use some contractors as well, but just tell us a little bit about the history of your firm.
Yeah, so Revenue Management Labs, we're a boutique firm. We're about 20 people, and our view on revenue management is that revenue management it's a discipline. We see it like finance, marketing, sales. It's just a discipline that companies need to have. And when you look at the leverage that price has on your financial statement, it's something that's too big for a company to ignore. So you need to have discipline around pricing and knowing how substantial of the leverage it has on your profit. So what Revenue Management Labs is all about is helping companies build competency in the area of revenue management, being an enabling partner, helping with customized solutions, because just like we were talking about before, every industry is different. The competitive set's different. How you go to market, how you make commercial different decisions is different. So in order, and pricing, I hate to say it, it should be something that's very data-driven. In a lot of organizations, there's a lot of emotion around it because you're affecting people's sales compensation, because you're affecting revenue, you're affecting customers, you're affecting, you're basically touching everything when you touch a price. So our key mantra is we want to be an enabling partner to organizations. We want to bring customized solutions. And the last element, which is most important for us, and that I usually harp on the most, is that pricing is something that has huge leverage on your financial statements. So we're incredibly focused on return on investment. So as we look at helping organizations, and just because if you're going to go through the hard work of looking at changing your pricing and getting it implemented, there should be a material change on your financial statements. So being able to track that through and verifying that you were able to see that lift does two things. One, it shows that you got the good work and the hard work actually paid off, but it starts to create momentum within organizations to start to really drive them down, continue to go down that revenue management pathway. Because in a lot of organizations, especially as certain industries mature, they've squeezed, we have a lot of people working on the cost side of the balance of the income statement. We also have a lot of people working around driving volume. Price and volume investments and thinking about mix, there's usually not as many people or no people in a lot of instances thinking about that and how to do it in a disciplined way. And when you look at the leverage on the financial statement, it's just too much of an opportunity not to be looking at.
Fantastic. Where can people who wanted to learn more about your firm, where can they find more about you?
Yep. So they can find us on the web at revenueml.com, or they can reach directly out to myself. I'd be happy, apanwasi@revenueml.com. We've got a lot of great materials on there from a revenue management perspective, and they can also find us on LinkedIn as well.
Fantastic. Well, Avi, I loved the example that you walked me through. It really helped crystallize for me the kind of work you do and also the kind of breadth of thinking that's required when you are trying to manage your revenue. I love the auto parts example. That'll stick with me. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you. Appreciate it.